Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. If you've ever traveled out west via I-80 or US 26, you've followed the Oregon Trail. But as you zip along at 65 or 70 miles per hour, remember that every 15 minutes or so, you've accomplished a Wagoneer's full day's travel. It's estimated that from 1840 to 1860, roughly 400,000 Americans made that 2,000-mile journey from western Missouri to the west coast along the Oregon Trail. My guest today says that the dangers were real, but not what you'd expect. Crossing rivers and streams, illness, or falling asleep at the reins and falling under the wheels of the wagon, not hostile Indians, was the biggest threat. Rinker Buck has studied the story of those who made it to Oregon and the skills needed to get there because in the summer of 2011, he and his brother became the first people to traverse the trail in 100 years by wagon. Believe it or not, you can still travel the actual trail for roughly 700 of those 2,000 miles. Despite having to fix broken wheels, snapped axles, which they did themselves on the trail, Buck says much of the journey is somewhat akin to what those pioneers experienced 150 years ago. In his book, Oregon Trail, he combines his journey along with an interesting history of the trail, from the history of mules to how religious conflict played a larger role in families deciding to go west than economics, to how scam artists fleeced the immigrants, selling them useless gear, then followed the wagon trains and picked up the discarded gear along the trail, took it back to Kansas City, and sold it again. It's a fascinating look. Rinker Buck is a former longtime staff writer of the Hartford Courant and author of three other books. His latest is titled The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. Rinker Buck, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Rich.
The idea of traveling the Oregon Trail in a wagon with the mules and the whole thing, how did this idea come about?
It started with a love of history, actually. It wasn't my idea to have a grand adventure, but that's how life works out sometimes. I came across a section of the Oregon Trail in Kansas when I was working on a piece of journalism about 6 or 7 years ago, and I became entranced by the trail, and I walked the ruts that day and ended up at a place called the Hollenberg Station, which was a road ranch, they called them, along the trail. And I became entranced by the trail because the actual history is so different from the myths that have been passed down. And I love writing books that tell people, hey, this is what really happened as opposed to what you've been told. So, you know, women played a very important part in developing the trail. The Indians were very friendly at first. There was just a huge amount of scamming by the outfitters. It was a very American scene. You know, the outfitters would talk the pioneers into overloading their wagons, and then 100 miles later, when the pioneers threw all the excess bacon barrels and everything over the side, the outfitters would have wagons waiting to pick it up and bring it back and resell it. That kind of stuff is really fascinating. So far, so good. Just a really good book, like a David McCullough book or something, written from the vantage of, say, a library. And then I came across this line. The last documented crossing of the Oregon Trail by covered wagon was in 1909. And I said, oh, that's the book. Let's just cross it. Let's be the first to cross it in 100 years. And it got started that way. And the reason that I felt empowered to do it was I had a horse background as a kid. And, in fact, we had wagons and everything, and that was our sort of family hobby. And my dad took us on a covered wagon trip when I was 7 years old. It was just from our farm in New Jersey to down to the middle of Pennsylvania, just a, you know, sort of 1 week junket down and 1 week back. But it retained a very strong memory for me, and it, you know, obviously helped inspire and enable me to take on this adventure.
One of the things you found was that we've lost a whole body of knowledge, as you might expect, given that it's been a century that somebody's done a basically transcontinental trip by covered wagon. Mm-hmm. And you really had to sort of rediscover a lot of that knowledge. Yes, there are still wagon makers. There are still men that would sell oxen, and in your cases, mules. But there's a body of knowledge that has been lost.
We couldn't find a wagon maker. We could find a wagon maker who did a beautiful job restoring the wagon, but we couldn't find one who knew how the brakes had to be built. And in fact, I went back into the Pioneer Journals myself and discovered that they used leather brake pads. And it sounds like a silly thing, but the brake shoes are actually made of wood, and that wood grinding against the iron tire rim wears down incredibly quickly. And within 100 miles, that brake is shot. So we found thresher pad instead. Nobody could tell us how many times we had to reshoe the mules. Nobody could tell us how we would get through this section of trail or that section of trail. There was just a multitude. Nobody knew how much water we should carry. And about 4 weeks into the trip, I decided, especially as we hit the deserts of Wyoming, I decided to add another 50 gallons of water capacity. And everything we did was just sort of like the pioneers. You know, I found an old plastic barrel. It had been used for carrying bakery syrup around in a little town in Nebraska, and I bought it for $3, and we built a whole extension of our cart that we were pulling behind us, carrying our provisions. Things like that. You know, we had to go over 40 miles some days to get to the next source of water in the real high deserts of Wyoming, and again, nobody predicted that we would have to do that. And one of the reasons the art is lost is that there are a few guys, outfitters, who take people on covered wagon rides for a week or two, you know, out on the land or cut off or something. But they have pickup support. Mm-hmm. And you know, they have a big line of pickups following them. And so they don't have to worry about water because they don't, and nobody knows anything about water anymore because they have a pickup following them. We didn't have that. We didn't want that. I wanted to do an authentic crossing, not have an air-conditioned RV pull in every night. So, yes, there was tons to learn and to reinvent.
And, of course, you just wanted to make the trip. It wasn't about, I mean, you did actually go on the ruts from time to time and actually were able to ride the actual trail. But most of the times it was highways paralleling or actually probably built within the ruts at times.
Yeah.
Or what I think you found most of the time was going parallel on a section road about a mile off the highway because you were sometimes riding right on the highway.
Yeah, well, and a lot of the times that we were riding on the highway, it was the actual trail. One of the things I learned, and I get into in the book, is that the trail is still very much a living, organic thing. Okay, the pioneers took it because it was the old fur trapping route through the Rockies, and there was a way to get over the Rockies at South Pass that was relatively benign. And so everything in the trail led to there. But then as soon as the pioneer era was over, then after the Civil War, then the homesteaders came, and most of them came by covered wagon. The railroads were very, Union Pacific was very anxious to get a line all the way coast to coast right after the Civil War. And the Oregon Trail was already there. It was already known. It was already surveyed. So they just put the lines, put the railroad lines along there. Now Route 80 is along there, et cetera, et cetera. And now there's big energy projects along the trail. So it's a living, organic thing. And we wanted to see, I wanted to tell in a book that was somewhat complicated in its agenda, but here's the history, and here's what's out there today. But just so you know, we did over 700 miles of original ruts. These are ruts that never got paved over. And there's one section, I call it the Acropolis section of the trail, from Casper to Cokeville, Wyoming, 350 miles of absolutely undisturbed original trail. And there's nothing out there. Nobody's out there. And it was just wonderful, romantic, fun, beautiful.
And you're talking open range in this.
Yeah, it is open range. There's a few areas that maybe are fenced, but I'll give you an example. You know, people always ask, well, how did you find your way? How did you get permission? And, you know, it wasn't really that hard. The first ranch we crossed off of Casper was the 75,000-acre Rattlesnake Grazing Association ranch. And then the next ranch was Split Rock Ranch, and that's 191,000 acres. It's 37 miles across. And the people that own the ranch knew we were coming. We didn't even have to tell them because it's a National Historic Trail and mules in a wagon have a right-of-way. But so, you know, we're spending a whole day, sometimes almost 2 days, on a single ranch, you know. But that was the best part, coming on the beautiful country of Wyoming where the trail is absolutely unchanged. But even when you're on the paved roads through Nebraska and other parts of Wyoming and stuff, it's still the same trail. You're seeing it as exactly as the pioneers saw it, and there's remarkably little development except a few places like Casper and Boise.
Right. Anybody who has driven alongside the trail, if you're heading out to Yellowstone or the West, the thing to keep in mind is, like, if you're in a modern car, every 15 minutes or so, that's a day's journey.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think you were making a little better time than the pioneers. You had roads, for example, in certain parts of the place, and you had mules, and they seem to be a little better than, say, oxen. But every 15 or 20 minutes, that's a day's journey.
Yeah, it was really a step back. We had a sign on the back of the wagon that said, you know, sorry for the delay in case anybody was backed up behind us, but we want to see America slowly. And seeing America slowly, I didn't realize this when we started the trip, but it really made for much better observations and I think a much better book. The covered wagon became sort of a social observatory for what America is today along the trail. And there's all kinds of social observations I made along the trail. We discovered a huge number of grandparents were raising their grandchildren because the methamphetamine epidemic has taken so many parents out and that sort of thing. And I was able to write about that. And then when I got back and checked the census data, it was one of three things that the Bureau of Census had highlighted in the 2010 census, that so many grandparents are now raising their children in the Midwest and the West. So ironically, a slow-moving covered wagon became an ideal platform in which to write about our modern country today.
Of course, you also include a great deal of history about every aspect of, I mean, everything from the history of how we built wagons during the 1800s. There's a great section on mules. You use mules instead of oxen, which I learned so much about mules, which I never knew. One is that they're more intelligent. I mean, we always think of mules as being stubborn and not as obedient as horses, but that's because they're more intelligent.
Yes. Yeah. Mules are great. So the first big breeder of mules, I call him the Maharaja of mules, was none other than George Washington. What happened after the Revolution was we were now going to push over the Alleghenies, and Washington and a number of founders like him had huge land holdings on the other side of the Alleghenies. That would be the new frontier, would be western Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Indiana. And so the horse wouldn't do in that kind of rocky terrain. We needed something stronger. And Americans knew about these mules that were available in Europe because the Europeans had always farmed with them. And you get a stronger animal when you mix the feral burro with a female horse. But the British had never been able to bring mules into the U.S. because the French and the Spanish, who controlled the mules, essentially wouldn't let them be exported into the U.S. because they had a big battle. They were the traditional enemy of Great Britain. Once the Revolution was fought and Washington was a global hero, the French and the Spanish couldn't be happier to send mules. And it was, in fact, George Washington who got it all started. Within 20 years after his death, there were almost 1 million mules in Virginia and the old colonies, and they just moved west with the population. And they were used in all of our wars. There were over 1 million mules used by the Union forces alone, carrying provisions and stuff in the Civil War. This was the animal that made America. And what I did was describe the development of the mule and how it paralleled and contributed to the development of America itself.
Yeah. And this is sort of what you do as you're learning about every facet of to make your journey. Mm-hmm. You're relating the history, all the guidebooks to the 19th century guidebooks to actually making the Oregon Trail. You were talking earlier about the outfitting scams of the merchants at the jumping off points like Westport and St. Joe. You actually sort of encountered your own version of that with an Amish farmer who was selling you harnesses and saddles for your mule.
Yeah. It was legendary that the pioneers would get fleeced because most of them were, a lot of them were homeless and relatively destitute. The American economy was very unstable, and they would lose their farms in a bank panic or whatever. And so they all just, Americans knew if you just head towards the Missouri River frontier with whatever savings you had, you could outfit a wagon and go west and get free land. And so they would arrive in a pretty vulnerable situation because the outfitters knew that they had to go, that the pioneers had no other recourse and whatever. So it was pretty common that they were sold green mules that weren't really trained well yet, but the outfitter would swear, oh, no, we've had them in harness for a couple of years, you know. And so we had our own, you know, the Amish are really good and they're an excellent businessman, and, you know, you're deceived by them because they look so pious and they have the old-fashioned garb and everything. But they horse traded with me a lot on saddles and made a lot of money off some saddles I had to trade in. And the mules we got, I paid a lot of money for. And it turns out one of them was kind of a crazy girl and the other one had bad feet. But, you know, we said we're not going to blame anybody else. It's our trip. We have to be responsible. But at every step of the way, there was some kind of pitfall or some kind of disaster or some kind of horrible weather or the rivers flooding and things that was identical to what the pioneers went through. And I was always saying, oh, this would be great. This is going to be great. We're in the middle of a disaster. And I would say, this is going to be great. This is going to be great for the book, because obviously the book would be good if we had a few disasters. And my brother, who was along, was basically saying, I hate your book.
Now, your brother was, he's apparently still a horseman.
Yeah.
And an incredible, it sounds like he is probably a 21st century, 19th century mechanical genius.
Yeah, well, if you want to There's actually a psychological term for a guy like my brother Nick, and they call him born out of century, you know?
Yes.
And so he's the guy, he actually made a living. We grew up in this horse farm, so he decided to make a living for the first 10 years or so after he got out of the Coast Guard. He actually made a living driving teams at a ski resort in New Hampshire where they don't allow traffic in, so they carry people around in these big sleighs. There's not many people who've actually made a good living for 10 years driving horses anymore. So that was who came along with me. He's a mechanical genius. He can fix anything. We'd have problems with the mules and, say, harness sores and that kind of thing. He knew exactly how to solve those problems. So, yeah, he's a remarkable character. And on top of that, he's very profane, and he thinks anybody who has a college education has essentially destroyed his brain. And so the byplay between us was always fun.
Yeah, no, and he seems like a wonderful guy to spend time with. My guest today is Rinker Buck, author of three other books. His latest book is about a cross-country trip via covered wagon on the Oregon Trail called The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. So as you're going down this trail, what was the thing that you were most looking forward to? Were there any big disappointments as you were crossing the trail? I think I read a line where, you know, you were surprised at, like, outside of Scott's Bluff, the mm-hmm. fact that right on the trail, suburbia sort of intruded on the trail. But what was the biggest thrill and the biggest disappointment as you were going along the trail?
I think the biggest thrill was just seeing the landscape as the pioneers saw it, because so much of it has never been touched or developed.
You can still, from miles away, you can still see Chimney Rock. You can still see Scott's Bluff. Yeah.
I explained to my readers that there was a natural chain of landmarks that the fur trappers had originally followed, and then the pioneer wagon trains followed, and you could navigate by these very accurately. And so Chimney Rock, which stands in western Nebraska, about 300 feet tall, you can see it because you're moving so slowly in a covered wagon. You can see it for 3 days approaching it, and then you use it as a departing waypoint, keeping it behind you properly for another 3 days. So I would say that was the biggest thrill, getting to a place, and I had read, for instance, Mitchell Pass, which is right beyond Scott's Bluff, and I had read in the diary of a pioneer whom I liked very much, Abigail Jane Scott, she writes about getting to the top of Mitchell Pass, and she could see the purple dome of Laramie Peak. And I measured it on the map, and it's 90 miles away. And I said, oh, boy, these pioneer ladies really knew how to exaggerate. And we got to the top. We had a really nice time in Scott's Bluff. And then we got to the top of Mitchell Pass, and it was a crystalline clear day. And there's the purple dome of Laramie Peak 90 miles away, you know. Those kind of things were really thrilling, that I just felt like I was rediscovering everything that I had read about the trail. The only kind of disappointment or thing that I can share with you is it's very hard to stay awake on a covered wagon. It's very exhausting. You're in the wind and the sun all day, which is dehydrating and exhausting. And so I would say by noon I had to get off. It didn't affect my brother as much. And so by noon, I would have to get off the wagon, and I would walk for 5 or 6 miles behind the wagon just to get my circulation going again. Because if you fall asleep on the wagon and fall off, you know, there's no sides on the seat, really, and there's no seat belts or anything like that. If you fell off, you'd either fall into the pulling trees and be clampered by the hooves of the mules, or you'd probably get run over by the wheels. And there were, I document and write about, there were just dozens of deaths that way in the Oregon Trail history. So I ended up walking. I figured I probably walked about 700 miles to the trail.
Wow.
So A, to stay awake, and B, to scout ahead of us where the trail wasn't clear.
Yeah. Now, one of the things, you know, one of the other big dangers other than falling asleep and falling off the wagon is stream crossings. Now, did you actually cross streams?
Yeah, we crossed a lot of streams. We didn't cross the big rivers because we didn't have a big covered wagon train with us and all that labor to, you know, take the wagons apart and put buffalo hide or something underneath them. But it was actually tougher to cross the rivers. So when we went across the Big Blue River in Kansas, near Marysville, Kansas, at the exact place, Marshall's Ford, where the old Pioneer Ford was, there's now a new modern cement span bridge. And we got up on top of that, and the mules panicked because they're essentially agoraphobic. And they you know, it's not in their DNA to look out to the side and be able to calculate, well, why am I 150 feet over the water right now? And so, and there was other things on the bridge that scared them, like the expansion joints. And we had everything we could do to keep them from a runaway. We had a sort of a near runaway, in which my brother and I sort of solved. And there was oncoming traffic, and people wanted to stop and take pictures with their iPhone cameras, which were flashing in the mule's eyes, and that scared them more. And it was there's a word for it, shall we say, a cluster, whatever, that we're not going to do on public radio. But it was just an amazing thing that we got across the bridge alive, because once they run away, it's really hard to suck them back in. But then there were many, many swollen streams, you know, good-sized streams. But I would walk the stream first so the mules could see me crossing it and knew that it was safe. And I also wanted to know how deep it was. And we probably crossed 30 or 40 streams. And then in other areas where the streams were too swollen, we had to divert and take so-called cutoff routes, of which there were many, many on the trail. And again, because I just happened to have done a lot of reading, I usually knew where the cutoffs were, and we could sort of meander our way down over the desert and find them and then get back on the ruts, you know, another 5 or 10 miles further.
I would think probably the most daunting part of that journey would be crossing the desert there, the Great Basin.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you have to remember we're in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. You know, even in that place, you know, it's 50 miles is no, it's not unusual to see nothing for 50 yeah. or 60 miles. And to think that's 5 days, 6 days without water.
Yeah. Well, Rich, you described to me that on family vacation stuff, you've crossed this country. And even in a car, you're just staggered by how, and you're, you know, racing by at 70 miles an hour, just how much vast country there was. And when I came back, I bought a pickup. When we successfully got to Oregon, I bought a pickup and drove home because we had a lot of gear to bring back. And I was just astounded. I cannot believe we crossed this. It takes you all day to drive across Wyoming, you know. But the biggest tough ones there was finding water. So and life was stripped down to the real elementals. You know, there were just whole stretches of weeks in there where there was only one thing we did with our lives, find water. So between the Big Sandy River near Farson, Wyoming, and the Green River, there's something called the Little Colorado Desert. And it's along a very popular stretch of the trail, what was a very popular stretch of the trail called the Sublette Cutoff. So we followed the Sublette Cutoff from the Big Sandy to the Green. It was 42 miles. It was 100 degrees plus. You're up around 6,000 feet there, et cetera, et cetera. And we would not stop. We could not stop until we had water in front of us, until we had the Green River. So we just went from about 5 in the morning, and we finally reached the Green 42 miles later after dark. But we had made the river, you know, and it was an extraordinary day. And there were all kinds of things about the wildlife and stuff that I was able to use to navigate properly. But those were the roughest days, you know, almost 50 miles across a desert with the covered wagon and mules. It's people listening might not want to try it.
Well, of course, one of the things you found was that, of course, on this very popular route to the Western National Parks, there are these flood of RVs. And yeah. I think that became one of the banes of your existence as you're driving on the shoulder of a highway with this mule team.
At some of my book signings, I'm expected to be accosted by RV drivers who tell me that I've been unfair to them. But, you know, the book is about the history. It's about the trail and our adventure and everything. But it's also a social observation about America today. And it's just staggering when you get some places where all these elderly people are in the RVs. And at a time of high anxiety in our culture over energy independence and energy costs, it'll just be fascinating, you know, 100 years from now, historians will look back and feel like elderly Americans took to the road in at this time of high concern about energy costs and everything in the most inefficient vehicle, you know, ever designed. I mean, I think those things probably get about 4 or 5 miles per gallon. And the people were just, you know, they stop on the road, see the covered wagon, and yell, how do you cook? How do you cook your food? You know, and one convenience store where we stopped. We used to stop at the Sinclair stores along the route because they had that big awning over the gas pumps, and it was a nice shady spot for the mules to rest for an hour or so, and we grabbed some water from behind the store and water the mules. Well, this one guy parked his RV downhill from the wagon, and the mules decided to take a leak, which in the case of an 1,800-pound mule is, we're talking several gallons of this glistening, beautiful yellow liquid floating down and blocking the entranceway to this man's RV, you know, and he says, hey, that's public urination, you know. So, that, you know, there was just every kind of, why don't you train your mules to go somewhere else, you know. So it just all kinds of unimagined contingencies come up that you never could have planned for.
What was the reaction of, you know, you're going through so many small towns along this route. What was the reaction from the people as you're going through their town on the route?
Just the enormous generosity and hospitality of the Americans in the West. I've done a lot of journalism, spent just a huge amount of time in the West all through my career for the last 30 or 40 years, and that is just one thing about the so-called flyover countries, just the generosity and curiosity and politeness of people. So, yeah, we'd get somewhere, and it was clear that we had to start camping, and there were a lot of the old pioneer camps are still there, but in other places, we're trying to figure out where to camp that night, and two ranchers would be there on the side of the road arguing over, you know, were they coming to his ranch or the other guy's ranch? You know, women would come up to us and go, you need a shower. I'll drive you back to my house for a shower. And I go, well, it's like, she goes, right now, the blue minivan, you know, things like that. No, people were really great to us. One of the things that I'm sure people in Oklahoma know is that if you go on these ranches today, because a lot of the little towns have died, you can't just run around the corner to get a part for your tractor. They have very extensive shops. And so when we needed to do repairs, we just pulled into a ranch and they threw open the doors to the implement shed. And Nick is a genius mechanic, and he was always astounded that everything that he needed was in there. So, yeah, it was a very big change for me, and I wrote about it. I'm the kind of person, I was raised in a Catholic household where you were taught, especially the boys, you know, you serve people, you take care of people, you never accept help. And so it took me a while on the Oregon Trail, but finally I just sort of woke up one morning and it was kind of like, you know, a big light was coming down from the sky, you know, hey, it's all right to live and accept the help and generosity of people, you know.
Rinker Buck, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, I really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Rinker Buck is the author of The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.